Good morning. It's Saturday, October 4th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Richard Jackson. Rick Jackson is the author of 9 books of poems and 4 chapbook adaptations from Pavese and other Italian poets. His own poems have been translated into over a dozen languages. He has edited 2 anthologies of Slovene poetry, edits an Eastern European chapbook series and 2 journals, and is the author of Dismantling Time in Contemporary American Poetry and Acts of Mind, Interviews with Contemporary American Poets. He was awarded the Order of Freedom Medal for literary and humanitarian work in the Balkans by the President of Slovenia. He has received Guggenheim, NEA, NEH, and Witterbinner fellowships, and has won such awards as the Prairie Schooner Reader's Choice Award, the Crazy Horse Prize, and 5 Pushcart Prizes. His work has appeared in Best American Poems 97, as well as many other anthologies. He was a Fulbright exchange poet to former Yugoslavia and returns each year with groups of students. He teaches at the Iowa Summer Festival, the Prague Summer Workshops, UT Chattanooga, where he directs the Meacham Writers Conference, and the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA program. I spoke to Rick in August during the Vermont College MFA in Writing Postgraduate Conference. In your essay, Reading Like a Writer, you refer to the process of thinking, which fascinated you more necessarily than the content of a poem when you were a student and first thinking about these things. And you said that the process revealed the mind and heart's struggle to put into words what seemed ineffable. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, for me, the poem is it's an art form, so it's a structure and a pattern of thinking and feeling. And I say both thinking and feeling. So, I mean, obviously we don't think about things and not have feelings about them, or have feelings that we don't think about. So it's both things at once. And for me, the whole notion of this idea of a process is the crucial thing. It's not, we were just doing a workshop and this morning, and I was saying that one of the first things I look for is the way the language moves from the beginning to the end. Regardless of what the theme is, or the subject, the philosophy, it's the music of it, and it's the movement, how something develops. And what that tells me is something about how the person is thinking and feeling. And it seems to me that that's why we go to literature in the first place, why we read poems or stories, novels, go to plays, listen to music, is that we're getting a sense of the way somebody else thinks and feels, which is to say, the way somebody else sees the world. And to me, that's a real humanizing thing, and it's the value of literature, the value of the arts. You see the world in a different way. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's not so much the conclusions that the person comes to. I mean, I can read Milton's Paradise Lost and disagree with the whole ultra-conservative philosophy, religious philosophy that's in that, but immensely enjoy the process of thinking that he goes through to get to that. Mm-hmm. And the chances that he takes in terms of, almost bucking up against his own theology and testing it with some of these characters. I mean, Satan is one of the most interesting characters in all literature, written by this ultra-conservative Protestant, Puritan, Milton. And it's interesting to watch how his mind works against that. Now, his whole philosophy at the end, the religious philosophy, when you sum up the book, is not so interesting to me, mm-hmm. but the process that he goes through is so crucial. For me, I think the first time I really came across this was when I was in college and reading Wordsworth's The Prelude, which is subtitled The Growth of a Poet's Mind. Mm-hmm. And it's that growth, it's that process from his beginning sense of mystery and terror and horror at some of the huge things in the world around him to his understanding that this terror is also what they used to call the sublime. Mm-hmm. It's also beautiful, and it's something huge, and it doesn't have to overwhelm you. You can sort of, like Byron says in one of his poems, expand into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that process then that's important. It's not whether Wordsworth is a nature poet or something like that. That's in many ways trivial. He's not talking about nature. He's talking about the mind that perceives nature and the way that it does that process again.
You also, in that same essay, you talk about the structure or the arc as being your basic first consideration. And I'm curious how that works, you know, for you, you know, as you approach, because certainly as these things are expanding and you're discovering as you write, so how do you plan structure first, you know?
Well, two things. One, in particular, when I look at poems, and particularly when I look in a workshop in a class, the first question I ask is, where are we at the end of the poem? It works for a story, too. Where are we at the end? Emotionally or tonally or philosophically, any kind of stance that we take at the end, maybe even just geographically. And then I ask them, where are we at the beginning? Where were we at the beginning? If those two are pretty much the same, what were we doing with all the stuff in the middle? Didn't go anyplace.
Mm-hmm.
And so the arc then, if it does go someplace, the arc is how do we get from the beginning to the end, the process,
right,
again, that we were talking about a minute ago. So for me, that's the most important thing when I'm looking at a poem as a reader. When I'm writing, at the very end, I'll pay attention to that. But when I'm writing myself, my process is I have a little notebook here, and I have a bigger notebook that I transfer things into. And there might be bits and pieces of conversation, something I've read, anything I've stumbled across, something I saw. And that might go on for several pages, and it's just these random notes about different things.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of trust that that's kind of the vocabulary of my subconscious, because why did I notice those things rather than other things? Well, I was in one mood or another mood,
mm-hmm,
because of something that was going on in my subconscious. So now I have a vocabulary. And I sit down to write, what am I going to write about? I don't really know. But I know I want to tap into my subconscious. And so I, you know, scatter through those, and either something there is going to jump out, or something there is going to remind me of something that I didn't add. And so now I've got a first line. Then where do I go? Well, what does that lead me to? And it might be something, because by now I've almost memorized the stuff that's in the notebook after going over it so much time. And then something else will come, and then something else. So it's this associative process that keeps going. And after a while, when you get closer to the end of the poem, it might be several drafts, or it might just be a couple of drafts to get towards the end, then you're beginning to think, okay, where is this taking me? Where is it taking the reader?
Mm-hmm.
Where is that arc? Where is it going to land? I want the ending to be a surprise, but I also want it to be related to what was, you know, going on through the poem. So the process of writing is similar to the process of reading, only in its last stages for me. At the beginning, it's more of a random thing. Just I could begin any place, and who knows where it's going to end up. And that's the fun of it.
I noticed that there's a lot of interconnectivity within your poems, and also between your poems, maybe in a certain collection, between ideas and images. In the poem Night Sky, for example, the hackberry embraces the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And then in The Silences, which is a separate poem, the moon is scratched by the branch of the hackberry. This was a lot of fun to recognize as a
mm-hmm.
reader. I'm curious if that's something that happens as you are creating, or if you kind of go back and look at what you've done and let it sort of feed what you're doing.
Yeah, the hackberry is a strange little tree. It's actually a shrub.
Yeah.
It's a bush with pretensions of being a tree, and it grows up and has very shallow roots, and in a storm it's usually the first to fall.
Is it thorny? Or?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's nothing like that. It's just an ugly looking. I mean, it's not really ugly. It's a big weed, basically. And it's, you know, has aspirations towards treedom. So I've always been fascinated by that, and also the paracantha bush was in a lot of earlier poems, and I do like to spend a lot of time outdoors, and so a lot of those, I mean, it's a vocabulary. If I lived in New York City, there would be different images, but they'd be sort of repeating. And I think that's kind of the signature. You know, I remember Philip Levine once talking about looking at Larry Levis's book, Elegy, and remarking to him how all the, there were so many repeated images in there. And Larry said, yeah, that's the way I want it. It's like a symphony where these things come back in different modes. And when I heard him talk about that, I started to think, yeah. And I think my last 3 or 4 books have a lot of that in them, and this new manuscript does too, which those poems you're referring to have those kinds of images that get repeated and with variances. So it gives you a vocabulary, and it's like listening to music. You know, you listen to a series of notes, say, at the beginning of a symphony, and then later on they come back, but they're colored entirely differently, and then maybe again, and more is added to them. Sort of like a refrain, mm-hmm. in a way. So I like that effect.
And with music, a refrain also affects the listener by giving them a certain comfort zone mm-hmm. by the end of the piece. And I wonder if that's not true, too, in a piece of writing, where they kind of come to recognize these things that mm-hmm. are traveling through.
Both recognize and be surprised, because it's appearing in a slightly different way.
Right.
So it gives them a say, oh, yes, I've seen that before, but oh, yes, it's differently.
Right. Yeah, and that's how I felt with that, the moon being scratched by the hackberry after mm-hmm. the hackberry had embraced the moon. That was kind of fun mm-hmm. to recognize.
Yeah.
How do you avoid letting those repetitions become almost mathematical? I don't mean you, but writers. Mm-hmm. How do we try to include the stuff that will surprise and create interesting connections for the reader without it becoming...
Yeah, you've got to be careful about that, because certainly you can overdo it. And I have gone back through things and say, oh, yeah, there's too much of this. Well, this sounds very, very close to what I did in this other poem. And either the poem goes or the lines change, or I try to pick up the poem in a different place and see what other direction it might go in. So yeah, you got to be real careful of that. I mean, a lot of people criticize some of the so-called deep image poets in the 70s and 60s because they used a lot of nature images. Stones especially seem to appear in just almost everybody's poem.
So who would be examples of that?
W.S. Merwin and Robert Bly. And,
okay.
Some of James Wright from around that time. But, you know, it was the vocabulary they were using. And I don't think it was so... I think it was an unfair criticism. It was part of the vocabulary, you know.
Right. People are influenced by the culture and what's happening now.
And they used those things differently each time they used them, too. It was not that they were just repeating them.
Transition and metamorphosis are very important to you in your poetry and in the works that you admire. So we talked a little bit about that, you know, making mm-hmm. sure that you're in a different place at the end than you are at the beginning, but also metamorphosis within the language itself. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about that a little bit more.
When I talk about in that essay, James Wright's poem, there's a beautiful poem called The Journey. The journey starts off as a little stroll on the countryside, mm-hmm. and then it becomes like a quest at the end. So there's a big change that way. And it's changed by how he uses the language, and particularly I trace through one word, dust. At first he says the area is gray and gold with dust, so it could go either way.
Right.
And then he washes the dust from his face, so you get a little more sense of time, passage, and mortality. He's playing off dust to dust, ashes to ashes. And then he sees a spider and surrounded by whole cemeteries of dust, I think is how it goes.
Right.
And then the spider actually gets free of the dust by going into the earth, which is going into the dust. And then he says at the end, you know, many men have searched all over Tuscany to find what I found, the heart of the light itself, shelled and leaved, balancing on filament, something like that. And then it goes, you know, the secret of this journey is to let the wind blow its dust all over your body, to let it go on blowing.
Right.
And you know, that's his consolation. I mean, it's a poem he wrote when he knew he was dying. And so how do you tell your friends, don't worry at the end?
Right.
Well, you transform this notion of dust into something that you have to live. And of course, then you're going to die. It's, I mean, it's sort of like, don't worry, that's the way it is.
That's how it goes.
But he does it by transforming that word and by saying, you know, and we're not just in a stroll, it's a journey. And the journey is ultimately into death, but also something beyond. And just using, playing off that phrase, dust to dust, ashes to ashes, that biblical idea, and you know that in the background he's thinking, yeah, there's something beyond. It's not really a religious poem or anything, but it's sort of saying, yeah, something transcends us, something's beyond. And that's part of the consolation of it. So you transform from a stroll to a journey, from just dust as a physical thing to dust as almost a metaphysical thing in there. So, and in that poem, Night Sky, you were referring to, you know, the notion of the asteroids at the beginning becomes, it's just a, you know, a physical observation. And then the notion of the asteroids and the stars and all that kind of stuff become metaphysical things towards the end of the poem.
Right, and there's another storm at the end of the poem, as I recall, a different kind of storm.
Yeah.
This might be a good time for you to read something from your work.
Okay, well, we can try Night Sky. This is a poem I wrote about, almost a year and a half ago, I guess. I should say one of the things about this poem, a lot of my poems use science, and it's because I actually began in engineering school for a year, and I still read a lot of science. In fact, I have Scientific American up in my room.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely is a presence in your poems.
There's a lot of metaphors in science, and you know, even if you go back to somebody like Dante, I had a student that wrote a great paper once on the science images and the math images in Dante. They're great metaphors. Okay, so Night Sky. Can you believe what the eloquence of these asteroids tells us? We are thrown through space from one explosion to another. How amazing any love has endured. In spite of the fact that so many tendrils of hope wither in the sun, in spite of the way the flowers now seem to feed on the bees, that the lake seems to shackle the sky, that the roots pull down the tree, in spite of the fact that the clouds drag the earth toward some new final solution, it doesn't matter where. There's a whole alphabet of hate, a syntax of torture we can hardly understand. Petrified promises take the day by the hand and lead her off into some jungle. A couple of cigarettes walk towards the dark end of a pier. A child's music shatters like a broken violin. I used to think that any love we could find is enough. It isn't. It isn't enough to plant our precious gardens of hope in the sky. It isn't enough to write by the fading candle of our eyes. It isn't enough to read some future by the petals of a flower. Never enough. We have to understand this love in the way the thorn defends it. We can't let the moon rest its drowsy head on our rooftops. We have to capture every wayward flash on the night sky and not let our words burn up in the atmosphere. We have to follow wherever they are heading. Sometimes I think we are all hurtling through love at the speed of light. Maybe it is a question of what galaxy we will crash into. Even now, you have to hear what the arrow says before it strikes. You have to know, I will follow you over rivers of stone, even while you hold my heart in your fist. That every love is filled with guilt. Every love tries to conquer a new world. I think sometimes we breathe through the pores of the earth. It's the only way we know the soul's body. It's the only way we can pass over the hobbled roads of hate. The only way to shudder as the birds shudder, crossing the horizon. I am watching a bat scoop the emptiness from the night, watching the hackberry embrace the moon. Sometimes we have to hold hands with our own nightmares. When I tell you that the voice of the nightingale turns dark, you have to understand what this love is trying to overcome. You have to know that if you ever leave, if you ever disappear, the sky would rip and the stars would lose their way.
Thank you very much for reading that. That was Rick Jackson reading Night Sky. What's the collection that this is from?
Well, it's new, and I actually just finished working on it and cutting down, I think it was 92 or 93 pages down to 70.
Oh, wow.
Which is workable. It might still be a little long. Ideally, I'd get it down to about 60 pages, and I don't quite have the courage to get out those other 10 yet, but I, you know, give it a few weeks and I will.
So, do you have it lined up with the...
The people that did my new and selected poems, Ashland Poetry Press in Ohio.
Do you have a title for the collection?
I think it's going to be called Resonance, okay. Which is also a scientific term. It has to do with what Einstein called spooky action at a distance, because he had no better term for it. The idea that disparate things are related, and that's why I like to put all these things in a poem and then somehow have them come together at the end. And again, a scientific metaphor.
Right.
The idea actually comes from the fact that if you take a beam of light, I hope this comes across on the radio, if you take a beam of light and split it, and off into two directions, okay? So it's the one beam split in two. And so you put a mirror over here on the right, on the right, you know, leg that's going off, and the beam of light changes direction, this one will too, even though there's no mirror.
Uh-huh.
And it's impossible for them to communicate, because they'd have to communicate at the speed of light. They have to communicate faster than the speed of light.
Huh.
It's impossible, but it happens.
Wow.
It's spooky. And so I like that idea as a metaphor for what can happen in a poem. You do something over here, and it affects something over here.
Inexplicably.
And then somehow at the end you realize, and that's the resolution, you know, we're talking about beginnings and endings in the arc. And the arc may seem to go crazy, and then at the end it comes together.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why, like, somebody like Ashbery or Dean Young, for instance, we were talking about both of them in workshop today, because they'll, you know, take you off and into the stratosphere and then somehow find a way to get you back.
Mm-hmm.
I love that kind of poem.
When I was reading the poems that you shared with me ahead of time, I found myself relating to almost every line in some way or another on a sort of personal level. And obviously it wasn't the same way that you, the poet, had related to the words that you were writing down. And I thought that was really interesting. The meaning of the poem feels on some level personal in a unique way to the reader. Or certainly in your poems, I found that. As if each reader is going to take away his or her own connection.
You want the reader to have some relationship with the poem. I'm just sort of talking abstractly now. But you also want the reader not to think, oh, this must be about the Holocaust or World War III.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain kind of limitations. It's sort of like the example I use is from baseball. Somebody's on first base and they steal second. People along the first baseline and the stands there look and they see he's out, definitely. And the people on the third baseline look at the play and say, he's safe. You know, and so which was he? Well, they both have different interpretations,
mm-hmm.
but they both have seen that somebody has gone from first to second.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing they have in common. Now, exactly how they call it, that's not so important, but they should agree on this certain thing happened. Same thing with the poem. There's some basic things that happen in the poem that people should pretty much all get. And but there are other things, you know, beyond that, and a lot of personal associations that you can make with things, which is why people have different interpretations of, mm-hmm. of poems, even critics,
mm-hmm.
and value them in different ways.
I want to talk a little bit about Slovenia. You spend a great deal of time in Slovenia.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, what was your introduction to that country, and how did your interest in its poetry begin?
Well, somebody suggested that I apply for a Fulbright there, and I did, and I got it. It was to actually form Yugoslavia before it broke up, and I had to cut that short because that was a year Chernobyl blew up and the winds were coming that way.
Mm.
But I went back the next year and took my family, took some students. We spent more time in Slovenia, and the first time I was there, I met a bunch of people. They came to the hotel I was in about 8 o'clock at night. They left about 7 the next morning. We just spent the whole time at the bar, and it was like I knew them forever. So I've stayed friends with all those people. A couple have died, but I've stayed friends with them and made other friends too. So, and I've always felt at home there, oddly enough. And when the war did break out, I was there, and because I used to go every spring and fall,
mm-hmm.
and now I just go every spring. I get sort of involved in some conflict. Some people needed somebody to help translate, put something in English about it was like a protest against something in the war. And then I get more and more involved in it. And so I did some stuff with Tess Gallagher about raising money for the refugees in Bosnia. And we, you know, put some letters in American Poetry Review and I think the Writer's Chronicle or something like that. And then I did some work over there helping to formulate you know, letters and stuff like that.
Is that in the 90s?
Yeah. The thing about it is, you know, you see a lot of stuff and hear a lot of reports about things that were really horrific, things that were, you know, they would be X'd out of this program if I tried to tell you exactly what you saw. Mm. And, you know, it was just, you know, horrifying, the inventive ways people can, you know, hurt one another. Yeah, that was, it was pretty horrific. So, yeah, I did a lot of work that, and I did a couple of anthologies of Slovene poetry, helped translate some, helped bring some writers to the United States and make them more known over here.
I know you won an award in 2000 from the president of Slovenia. Mm-hmm. What was that award?
It was the Order of Freedom Award, sort of like a Medal of Honor in the United States, like a Citizen's Medal of Honor. And it was because of all the stuff I had done for Slovene literature and that humanitarian work, raising that money and helping organize some relief and stuff like that. Like we did in it, I got a small school, Elgin College, out near Chicago, to do an anthology. And all the money from the anthology, several thousand dollars, went to, which doesn't seem like a lot to us, but is a lot over there, was a lot over there, to help get some refugees out, mostly writers and journalists, because those are the ones who are being targeted, mostly. Mm. To get them out of Sarajevo when that was under fire and other parts of Bosnia. So it's sort of in recognition for that, is what that award came from.
Now, do they speak English? Do you speak other languages?
I can get along in Italian and in Slovene. I can basically order, say hello, and a few other things. The thing is, they know English is better than some of my students. And the thing is that you go over there and you say a few words and they say, oh, that's really good, thanks for trying, now let's talk English, because they want to practice, and there are more of them. Right. So you never really get a chance to practice it at all unless you go over there and take a course, which I've never had the time to do, or the money, really. So you know,
that would lead me to believe that you have not gotten into translation. But
well, the weird thing about it is that I can, that's speaking, because they really speak fast, and it's hard to tell how one word is separating from another if you don't know the language that well. But when it's on the page, I can read it, with the help of a dictionary, I can do pretty good with reading it. And in fact, I translated a book of poems last summer that came out last fall. It's called The Journey of the Sun in English, and it's like about a multi-part poem, 18 or 20 parts, and each section is almost like a poem, and it's like a little quest poem, and really interesting, and the book was done beautiful paintings in it. And,
published here?
It's published over there, actually, yeah.
For any writers who might be listening, if you have any advice for what to do or what you like to do when you get stuck in your work?
I've done a couple of things. I find it helpful. Well, one thing you can do is just simply write. Just say, today I'm going to write the worst possible junk I could ever write. You sit down and do it, and pretty soon, you know, something comes out and it's not such junk. That's the easiest thing to do. And it's an attitude thing. You know, or you can do the opposite. You can say, you know, today I am really the Nobel Prize winner in waiting, and I am just going to write that way and pretend that no matter what I write, it's just great. That's the other side of doing that. In more practical ways, I will actually turn to translating. I'm much more comfortable translating from Italian. I translate a lot of Pavese and a lot of stuff from the 16th and 17th centuries. Mm-hmm. And that helps you, sort of gets you going. And then there are sort of exercises you can do. I have a whole bunch that I've put on a disc of different kinds of exercises. You know, make a list of things and try to use them all in the poem. Things like that. Or, you know, I know a writer who will pull out several books off of his bookshelf. Various kinds of books, you know, maybe a book on jazz, one on plumbing, and one, you know, and just randomly pick out some phrases and say, okay, this is my, I'm going to make something out of this.
Huh.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then he gives himself license to change things and go off in any direction he wants, but that's what he's going to start with. Those are his triggers.
Yeah.
So those are good things to do. You know, anything that's random, I know people will go down and say, okay, I'm going to randomly open up the dictionary, go down the second column and pick every 11th word, because 11 happens to be my number for the day, or because it's, you know, June 11th or something. And you'd say, okay, you got five or six words, and somehow I'm going to use these in a poem. And, you know, it may not turn out to be very good, but the point is you start writing, and usually writer's block or just not being able to write comes from the fact that somebody thinks, oh, I've got to write something important, I've got to do something really big, and so they get sort of tied up. But start small, start with something trivial, start with something accidental, mm-hmm. like that. And remember that movie Accidental Tourist? You know,
right.
You want to be an accidental tourist in your own poem.
Yeah.
And just take what comes and see where it goes. And if it's too bad, so okay, you know, it's not the end of the world. And writing a bad poem is not like shooting someone.
You know. All right, well, that's really good advice. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rick Jackson. Next week, tune in for a conversation with the writer Kathy Giorgio, founder of the All Writers Workplace and Workshop, a creative writing studio in Waukesha, Wisconsin, an editor, owner, and publisher of the literary magazine Quality Fiction. I'm very happy to tell you that this program is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit autismsupportdaily.com or call 985-8773. It's the Radiator's birthday this month, and you are invited to join us at Big Heavy World, the Radiator, and the Vermont Music Library for an open house on Saturday, October 11th from 6 to 8 p.m. We're at 215 College Street on the third floor over Stone Soup and Pure Pop. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Hike Bedrosian is up next. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.